The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2023. I'm now here with Maven Politic. Maven, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience?
Hi, yeah, I'm Maven. Many people know me from Twitter or appearing on Academic Agents channel a number of times. But yeah, I'm a Brit. So I like to think of myself as something of a low-level organizer. And I talk about migration and all sorts of things online. So that's me.
Okay. And what would you say is the because you said that you want to talk about cultural shifts. And I think this is an interesting, because you said over the last 12 months or so, I think that's an interesting scope. Would you like to talk about Britain in the early 2020s prior to this shift and what you think were the salient forces at the time?
Well, what I was meaning really is... there's been a note when we people with opinions such as ourselves and the people listening to this, people on the, you know, the dissident side of the right, when we talk to people, we have to hide our power levels, right? And we accept that when we're in public or at the pub or even speaking to some friends and family, we can't say quite our own opinion because our own opinion is, you know, frowned upon. But that's changing a bit in the last year or so. The reasons why I'm not fully worked out, but I think it's something to do with the fact that the mainstream is completely bankrupt of ideas, the left are bankrupt of ideas, and there's this massive reemergence of real problems on the world stage, whether those are economic or migration or in terms of war, right? So we're looking in the last year or so, we've seen in the Ukraine-Russia front, we've seen Russia really do quite well, and it's looking like next year they're going to completely trounce the Ukrainian forces in one way or another. We don't know exactly how that's going to pan out, but it's looking like Russia's effectively won their objectives, or they just need a bit more time to actually, you know, implement it. We're seeing in Israel, the Israeli forces have not been very successful against Gaza. You know, you can say what we like about who's right and who's wrong, but it was generally accepted that the Israelis were the superior fighting force, and when they would go in, they would, you know, win handily. That's not been the case. The Palestinians, for whatever reason, have been much better at fighting back than anyone would have assumed. At the same time, we've had this massive economic issues. You know, this is partly the legacy of lockdown and all the money printing. But at the same time, it's you know, in the UK and in the EU a bit more widely, in particular, as opposed to America, where America is still a bit more economically healthy. This is really the legacy of lack of investments in all sorts of things. It's the result of wage suppression at the low end in particular because of migration. You know, we've in the UK, we've had 1.2 million migrants last year and 1.1 million this year, something like that. So people are realizing that what they've been told for the last however many years is just wrong, and not just wrong in a way that it was wrong in COVID. What it was, because in COVID, when people realize, oh, there's a bit of mistake, you say, well, the science has changed, etc. But when it's your entire worldview when it's the way that you look at, when you, it's the way that you think the whole country should be organized, it's a bit different. So as a result, you know, our ideas are becoming a bit easier to speak.
I would say, in a sense, COVID was the peak of the post-war West, in a certain sense, in the sense of resources, logistics, high IQ, the organizing all of that was like with the migrant crisis before it. It must have been a huge operation. All of the PR, the nudging, all of the brains and research, it must have been a huge thing. And then the actual goal to protect public health. I mean, I'm not saying that that was the goal, but, you know, ostensibly. That whole thing, it was like, we're keeping people safe. We're keeping the public in the civilized West will be kept safe by responsible governments using systems that work, efficient, well-managed systems of resource gathering, resource distribution, need monitoring, all of this kind of stuff.
I think that's right. Because also, if you remember all the press briefings which happened, there was all these new public health officials and scientists that no one has ever heard of before, which it gave this illusion that there was depth of talent.
Yes, exactly. I can imagine a normie in the middle of COVID thinking, well, at least there's all this infrastructure to look after us. Mm-hmm. At least look what we've got. We're lucky. It's crap. Lockdown's depressing and whatever, but thank God. And the scientists working on a vaccine and all that. Thank God we've got all this. The West might be dark right now, but it's sophisticated and it works. And I think, since then, you've had the US withdrawal from Afghanistan, you've had the disastrous war in Ukraine, and now the very ugly war in the Gaza conflict. And I think and you've had the politicians just slavishly supporting one side in that conflict. Mm-hmm. So I think these things signal to the public, actually the West isn't as powerful and safe and secure as it seemed 3 years ago. We can't fight against Russia. We can't fight against the Taliban. we can't. And let's say there seem to be moral ambiguities about our involvement and our support of Israel. So in various ways, I agree with you that the worldview of the normie is probably shaken, and that's without going into all the, you know, Nord Stream. I mean, that's the whole thing, and the cost of living crisis, which is now a thing. That phrase is used a lot,
and it's a terrible name. It's a terrible name for inflation, but it's everywhere, and people are talking about it. But I think that the Russia thing, as you mentioned there, is particularly jarring, I think, for anyone who's interested in geopolitics, because you would say, okay, we're supporting Ukraine in a war against what is now the second or third biggest army in the world, probably the most lethal army in the world at the moment. Let's, you know, build a factory to make the munitions. That hasn't been done. These simple steps, which you would assume you would do if you were supporting a major war, just no one's done it. So, you know, people are wondering where are the experts? They're not in government. They must be somewhere else. So people are just looking away from mainstream consensus, mainstream society, than where you normally get opinions. And as a result, people are coming up with all sorts of crazy things. You know, there's a lot more people talking about satanic pedophiles in the media. There's more people talking about communism. There's more people talking about all sorts of things. But at the same time, it's more people talking about the ideas in the dissident right and, you know, former alt-right that we've been talking about for years. So I think it's a really interesting shift. I gave an example briefly earlier, but I was at an event in the summer in a pub in Birmingham, and we were, you know, having a smoke outside, and we're talking to a few people who were not at this event with us. And, you know, after a few minutes, this guy decided that we were all terrible racists and, you know, whatever. And he started calling us a few names, but none of his friends were backing him up. Whilst if that was to happen a number of years ago, certainly pre-COVID, probably even last year, his friends would also start backing him up and, you know, calling us the same names.
Yeah, that is interesting. It's ironic that that would happen in Birmingham, of all places.
Well, these inner cities are really interesting, actually, because the white guys who are left are either super woke or super racist, and there's no in between.
Well, I guess they're forced to. I mean, it's either going to be the brainwashed drone who believes whatever the BBC tells him, or it's going to be the guy on the ground who's suffering the effects of it, is feeling the alienation, seeing the how an area changes when it changes demographically.
Hmm.
It also changes physically, and is going to be pretty burnt out with it. I mean, I don't expect that the last whites in the East End are going to be very happy people.
No, they don't tend to be. And the public polling is pretty poor on picking this up, because they just look at the aggregate data rather than what's happening on the actually these individuals on the ground. But that's slightly beside the point. What's happening then is, when people are saying, okay, we don't believe in the current ideas, we don't believe in the current paradigm, where are we going to look? And so you can go to if you look at the left and you say, when was the last time the left created a new philosopher or thinker or created an interesting book? Open question to you. Off you go.
Oh, well, I think if we're talking about the left, it's a desert. I mean, the left has really just supported the status quo up until, I mean, you could say with the Israel thing now, it's that there's a divergence appearing there. I think there is, but I don't know how consequential it will be. But certainly, you know, from 2010 onwards, really from Occupy onwards, so ever since Occupy was felled, as it were, or however, I don't know, it died out. I actually can't remember how it ended now, but one way or another,
yeah,
a few years later, it was Pepsi and big corporate trademarks at the Gay Pride March.
Exactly. So they're dead, essentially. There's the last interesting movement in British politics on the left was Jeremy Corbyn, who is an ancient man trying to rally old support for old ideas.
Yes.
You have the Navarre Media crowd who even those, like you have Bastani, one of the guys in charge of Navarre Media, will regularly now quote tweet guys from Anglo Twitter and engaging in our ideas and conversation, because, you know, although he's a dyed-in-the-wool communist, he seems to recognize his side is boring and he's looking for something else to engage in. The last interesting academic that the left had was, I think, Mark Fisher, who was a student of Nick Land, which is one of our guys. So he was just laundering our ideas even then. The last ever academic, which probably was interesting in the UK, was a guy called David Graeber, who passed away, I think, last year or relatively recently. But towards the end of his life, his latest book was one called On Kings, this anthropological study on the structure of tribes and hunter-gatherers and stuff and how they organized. So, you know, On Kings means, you know, how did they organize their leadership. And that book is moderately reactionary. It's not reactionary in the full sense, but it's certainly a departure from his previous ideas. So even him, which is, you know, a guy, he's the one who wrote Bullshit Jobs, you know, if you remember that book from years and years ago. Even he was moving rightwards towards the end of his life. Someone mentions in the chat Slavoj Žižek, and, you know, he's, yeah, he produces nothing of interest. So the left is completely demoralized and they're bankrupt of ideas. And the all they can do is say, well, maybe this one new category group is worth propping up somehow. So let's look at black people this week. Let's look at women this week. But they don't actually have any new ideas of how to do anything. And the center's no better. The centre hasn't. The last interesting person on the centre was Jordan Peterson. There's been no one interesting since him. And they've been running around desperate to try and find someone. And
the thing is, I mean, I know that Jordan Peterson people often talk about his 90s stuff. When he first became a public academic, so to speak. But in terms of like 2015 onwards, I would say he was right. He was interesting only to the extent that he was right wing and deviating from the norm on the trans stuff. But mm-hmm. other than that, I don't know. I don't want to disparage the guy unfairly, but I don't think he's very interesting.
Yeah, and it's as you say, he was doing some interesting stuff when he was engaging with some of our ideas, and he was asking, you know, when does the left go too far? And I think that was an interesting public conversation that he had. But then he had he went into a coma and has not been the same since. So even whatever energy he had and was able to give to a more centrist movement has died since then, and now he just works for the Daily Wire, which is not exactly where you want to be if you're a vital person.
no, indeed. I think they've very much... I mean, he's just a slave now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So where do people turn? You know, if you look at the mainstream right, no, there's nothing there. The mainstream right, you're going to... Trump, God bless him, is probably going to win. However, he himself is not creating ideas. He's probably going to win the election and become the president. Not sure what's going to happen to America since then, but he's not exactly going to... He doesn't seem full of new ideas, new ways of governing. The only people that seem to be producing new ideas and are literally our sphere, our little sphere on the internet, when we talk about what we do. And then there's Milei in Argentina, and there's Bukele in El Salvador. And maybe then you can look at some of the things the Gulf states are doing as well as something a bit different with Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi. But otherwise, everything is completely stagnant. So people have to look to these new places. And one of those new places is literally us. So my question, an open question, and maybe the rest of this discussion is, if we see what we're seeing, I'll expand on that a little bit first, actually. We're starting to see a lot of laundering of dissident right terms in centre-right to centrist media. If you search for anarcho-tyranny, 2 years ago, that would have popped up on niche blogs, on Twitter, on 4chan. Anarcho-tyranny is now in British newspapers. I had a few other things written down for that. Hang on. One moment, please. Yeah, The Great Replacement, for instance, again, is something which came out of France. And if you said The Great Replacement in the Western world, in British politics, in American politics, you would be completely castigated. And now people are talking, you know, yes, it's Vivek Ramaswamy, who is an Indian. But it is at least... Now,
I agree. I don't think the fact that he's an Indian negates the point that his mentioning that is important. It matters. You could say that the only danger would be that it matters in a bad way, that he's going to co-opt it, or they'll change it into Democrat voters. You know, they're importing Democrat voters. That would be retarded. But I can imagine, you know, they're Tucker. Kind of did that about a year ago, but I agree with you though. On the face of it, this is a good thing. It's a good development, and I wonder how they're going to acknowledge this. You know, the BBC journalists a year from now I don't want to predict the future, but I would suspect that from now on and in the near future, BBC journalists are going to have to acknowledge the Great Replacement as a thing, without acknowledging that they themselves denied it again and again.
I think that's absolutely right. And it's particularly important that they're using the words "the Great Replacements" rather than a synonym for this. So these terms, people have been trying to launder DR terms for a while before. If you remember Eric Weinstein, he used to talk about what he called the distributed idea suppression complex. Or DISC.
Right.
And the distributed idea suppression complex, was basically Yarvin's idea of the cathedral, but watered down. And he would go on Joe Rogan, and he would go on these various podcasts, and he would present this as his idea, but really it was, you know, one of our thinkers, just he just watered it down a little bit. But when you're using a new term, when you're using a new terminology, people can say, wow, that's his thing. And so if it is going to be slightly twisted, you can get away with it. When you're using the words verbatim, the great replacement, anarcho tyranny, when you then want to say, okay, well, let's look at the Wikipedia entry for this idea, let's start going back on Google Scholar and Google Trends and seeing when this was mentioned previously, the etymology of the phrase becomes really clear. So when the BBC, as you say, they're going to be forced in some way in the next year or two to acknowledge the existence of this term and this theory, they won't be able to hide its heritage. And I think that's very important. The same is true of anarcho-tyranny. People, it's not a word which is intuitive, so you have to look at what it means. And when you look at what it means, it comes up with spandrel, right?
Yeah. And do you think that this is going to have tangible effects? I mean, it seems that it will. It seems to me that this is a positive development, I think.
I think it's a very positive development.
We've struggled for years, just to lay the ground here. We've struggled for years to popularize these terms and awareness of them. So now that it seems to be happening, it's almost too good to be true.
Yeah, I am. It can be too good to be true. There was even a BBC review of the first Doctor Who episode of this new season, which was talking about the message, which is, a critical drinker term in which they use to like criticize wokeness. So even people within the BBC are slowly catching on to this. The danger is, as you say, is it too good to be true? Are people just going to take these ideas who are not actually part of our, they don't have the depth of our thought. They just can say, they can just repeat a few of these talking points. And then they just say, all right, we're going to use this as the highlights of their campaign to do more of the same. They can, it's just the, I don't know what you call it, it's just the bread and circuses of the new campaign which they're going to run. They're going to say, we're just going to be more rhetoric, no action. So what we need to do now is say, okay, we need to find these people who are laundering these terms, whether they're Vivek or random Telegraph writers, or weird BBC media reviewers. We kind of need to find these people and find ways to mentor them, if you like, but from the shadows, because we can't really go out and shake their hands and say, oh, I want you to work for me, because we don't have the ability to do that. We don't have the ability yet to create an institution which is going to like set up the entirety of the distant right and say, yeah, like the Mises Institute does for libertarian economics. We're not at the place where we have that, where we can do the same for our ideas. So what we can do though, as individuals and small network groups of people, is find the people that are clearly sympathetic to our ideas and try and radicalize them, essentially, so that when real politics makes its re-emergence in the relatively near future, between 1 and 10 years, when it's obvious that Russia's achieved all its geopolitical aims, when Israel's completely sacrificed all of its credibility because of its war in Palestine, when the economic situation, because of the retarded policies that we have in the West, is extremely dire, there's going to be this opportunity for a true circulation and cultural flip, and we need to make sure that it's happening on our terms, right, in our direction, and not in just some other random direction using our language and our ideas as window dressing.
It's a strange situation to be in, because we've been talking for so long, and I think a lot of us have, after 2016, sort of lost sight of the idea that we could actually change things, which is a sad thing, but it's inevitable, really, when after the way Trump went and all of the developments that we can lament. I think we forgot that, well, we do actually have influence. And with Elon Musk's Twitter, I think we have more influence than we've had for years, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the Twitter thing has been a massive boon to our side. You know, getting, you were brought back, weren't you?
Yes, I was in February or March. Yeah,
yeah, and
I was kind of surprised, but I did. I thought it would take longer for them to approve me, but yeah, Morgoth and I both got back in pretty much at the same time.
Right, and so there you go, two good fighters back in the public square, when before you're on Telegram and these other places honing your craft, but now you can come out.
Yes. And it is very useful. So to get back to the practical matter, how do you think that we can prepare the ground so that when things go bad, people look to us? We should say first that the left are obviously bereft of ideas. Mm-hmm. The centre is bereft of ideas, and probably I think that's just in the nature of the centre. The centre averages things from either side, but it is not really a source of ideas in itself. Maybe pragmatic political ideas, but not, you know, intellectual ideas.
Sure.
Not visions for society. So they are both bereft. The right, the establishment right, is bereft and largely just taken. And I mean, what the Tories have done is outrageous over the last 10 years. So yeah, I agree with you. And so the question becomes, what should we do now?
Yeah, so we need to basically find ways to network, whether you're within the audience listening to this, and you just need to, you need to find ways to network with like-minded people in your, you know, your local area, or and people online, and you know, whether it's people that are appearing on this channel, you know, this channel, this millennial event is a form of organizing itself, is a form of networking. So this, what you're doing is actually, I think, quite beneficial, because it helps bring people together and show and distribute these ideas in a good way amongst our people. We need, but when you have these networks, these lots of what, you know, what Burke would call little platoons, I guess, these small power sources, you need to then direct them at the people that are sympathetic, or that you notice are sympathetic. So let's just talk online, right? Everyone, that Twitter's now a space where we can take the fight to people who disagree, who are not aware of us or who disagree with us. But there are many people that are clearly borderline, right? That are starting to launder our ideas. You can literally just, we need to be saying, when they are saying something which we agree with, we need to be basically amplifying that message, right? And going really hard in their comment sections against the detractors, so that when someone does take a step towards our side, they are meeting warm waters, right? And so then they're more likely to take another step. Now, this doesn't mean that you get these people and put them on a pedestal and say, oh well, you know, we've got this base black guy on our side, we're gonna win now, but it does mean that when these people take and start using our ideas, we don't attack them for it. We say, yes, we are correct, and we are going to support you because you have finally done said something correct and something right. You know, you are in support of deporting people from the country. I don't care where you got that idea from. I don't care that, you know, when Douglas Murray did this, for instance, this year, you know, he was doing it because he is radically in support of Israel, right? That's what pushed him over the line to being in support of deportation. Now, being radically in support of Israel is not something we're interested in, but deporting thousands and thousands of people from the country is something we're interested in. So when these things happen, we need to be able to pick up that energy where these more established types, which, you know, have weight just because of who they are and their history, you know, and we just...
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think the danger, and this is something that people on our side are hyper aware of, is that you end up strengthening someone who, like Douglas Murray, who then uses that strength against you.
Right, but I think when we're these Douglas Murray is one of these people that he himself is now kind of bereft of ideas, right? We're only strengthening him to the extent that he is using our ideas. If he was to then turn against us, he would be turning against us, like not using the energy which strengthened him in the first place. He would be turning against us with the weaker version of himself. And I think we need to be quite confident about our own abilities and our own vital energies when we do this. Yes, it's a, if we were to, as, that's what I said, when we, not to put these people on a pedestal is my point, right? So we don't want to be saying we want to elect Douglas Murray into Parliament and to take over and to take over foreign policy and to become or to be in charge of the Home Office because, oh wow, now Douglas has said the things we want. We say no, you keep your job as a journalist, you just repeat our ideas and we'll support you, right?
yeah.
And I think that's how you do it.
I think that's a very good point that you're making here about the distinction between supporting someone when they're saying a particular thing and putting that person on a pedestal. Because they could turn at any moment. So it's not a matter of worshipping them. It's a matter of supporting them when they're doing the thing you want.
Yes, yes, exactly right. And I think there's going to be a lot of that now. So we've seen, on the trans question, for instance, there's now a big movement in the UK in particular of these TERFs. You know, J.K. Rowling's their spiritual figurehead, and you have people like... Linnican and Mary Harrington and Miriam Coates in the Tory party and all these people, and they're not saying our ideas publicly on you know any of these issues, but I know if you speak to some of these people in private, they're a bit more base than they let on, and they are reading your ideas. So when these people are saying things, we say, okay, yeah, we know they're feminist. And we know they want to do whatever they want to do that we don't like, but we're going to support these points. But we're only going to do it on our language and in our mindset.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the reasons that I have always wanted to reach out and do videos not about politics necessarily, but about cultural things, apart from the fact that that's my interest anyway. I also think it's good for us to do that because it brings people into our orbit who might otherwise run a mile because they would just see, okay, well, that's not my politics, so it's of no interest to me. Earlier this year I wrote an essay about Sinead O'Connor, and next year I'll be doing a whole set of essays on this on Substack about the 80s Britain. And hopefully people will discover those who aren't familiar with me, aren't familiar with my work, but find a common interest in that. And in reading those essays, they might well start to think, well, actually, he's not an alien, he's not a villain, he's not insane, he's not evil, and become a bit more amenable to our worldview. Again, that's not the reason I write these things, but I think it's a beneficial side effect of it. I can't remember any examples now, but I'm sure that people have found my videos back on when I was on YouTube. And this has happened. I think it's important not to scare people off, basically. And this is something where our movement hasn't been good in the past. I think we've gone in for purity spiraling an awful lot. Now, sometimes it's useful. Sometimes it's to hold someone's feet to the fire, so to speak. But other times, you catch more, whatever the phrase is, more flies with sugar than vinegar, whatever I can't remember the term. Mm-hmm. But I think we should try to be friendly. It just seems like common sense.
Absolutely. And when you say, you mentioned, you know, your essays on Sinead O'Connor and all these other cultural things you're planning, I think that's really key, actually, because the right has been phrased, we've been phrasing the right in negative terms for a long time now, you know, the phrase clear the mouth, as Bowden said, and just saying we're against this, we want to get rid of this, etc. However, the right is more than that, right? The right really is the romantic movement. It's the we are the people who are into things like love, and, you know, romance, proper romance and companionship. We are into the love of nature and the protection of it. Right-wing stories tend to have more fleshed out, complete human beings centered in them. It's kind of impossible to write a story or film a film with deep characters without in some way being on the right, or at least admitting its existence and that it has positive characteristics. So what our guys, you know, need to be doing really, as part of a way of expanding their online content, right, if you like, is talking about this sort of thing and praising these old strengths of the right wing. You know, we are the poetic romantic types, and that's not anything you should be ashamed of.
Oh, I certainly agree. I think that this was a key part of being right wing up until the 70s. I think the old conservatives like C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, and Scruton was definitely romantic. It had a romance about the nation and history and the people, and that goes down to your own town. It wasn't just logistics and economics. And I think that Thatcher really, I don't want to condemn her completely, but I think that era of so-called conservatism really just warped conservatism into being that, into being a robot who cares only about the economy and the GDP. And that's, and no wonder then that the country's gone to the dogs.
Yeah, I mean, Thatcher's an interesting case, because the economic reforms weren't perfect that she did, but they it was clear that at that time, serious economic reforms in the country were necessary, and we did need to move towards a more market-based system of one kind or another. I think, you know, the way that she did privatization was probably incorrect. That could have been done very differently. Certain things could have gone faster, certain things could have gone slower. But big changes needed to be made, because since the beginning of World War II, the British state was exerting basically full socialist control over the country. And the only reason Britain was functioning was because they had such high levels of competency and talent and education within the country and within the people running it, that we're able to make a socialist system kind of work. But we still have rationing until the late 60s, I believe it was. There was still rationing in the UK. The level of socialism and control was kind of ridiculous, and it was damaging our long-term place in the world. So Thatcher was necessary to be then. But because the left were in control from that point onwards, the left then from World War II was able to claim some of this, what we now call conservatism. What we call conservatism is able to claim some of this label. The left was saying, oh no, the NHS is a conservative. Labour would say the NHS is about love for country. They would say,
yes,
having a nationalised rail system or you know, whatever it is a conservative project in some way. And the working class Brits really bought into that idea. So Thatcher, when she went against that, she was also, I think inadvertently, I don't think she realised this particularly, she was going against this conservatism that we this you know, love. She was going against that as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think that a lot of people probably voted for her who were very much on our wavelength, who just wanted the post office to stay there in the town. They didn't have to go to the next town along. And they wanted the pub to stay there. It'd always been there. You know, the cosy stuff that you almost feel silly saying it because it's so twee and quaint. But what else is Britain? what else are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to love the shitty cities, the boring new build estates?
I mean, I mean, it's a weird thing being British, right? Because the rest of the world doesn't have, when we say these, you know, twee little things like the post office and the pub, that is literally British society. Britain was unique in Europe and unique in all of world history, really, in that the structure of society was not based around the individual family unit. You hear when you when Americans say that, like, oh, the family, the nuclear family is the bedrock of America. And that's kind of true for the Americans when they went over, because there was the Pilgrims and there was this big religious movement that created America, and then held on all these waves of migration from places like Italy, where, you know, the family was the bedrock of society. But in England, that was never really the case. In England, the bedrock of society was these voluntary associative groups. It was the pub, it was your church, it was people who would work, you know, at the post office or whatever. It was the system of tradesmen and apprentices. And the guild systems, which meant that in the, you know, at the peak of industrialization, where everyone was working in a factory or one of these, like, you know, real jobs that no one else has anymore, everyone would be unionized in one way or another. But the unions are small. The unions were based around these small associative groups. When that same level of industrialization happened in France and Germany, the unions were massive, right? Because they didn't have that same history of small localized associations to build upon. The Working Men's Club is a British institution. It's not a German institution. These small associations, which, you know, you say defending them sounds twee, but it's literally, that's what British society is and why it's unique. And, you know, it's hard to see that sometimes within Britain. But when you move abroad and, you know, look at these other countries, you see none of this exists. None of it exists in China. It doesn't exist in Germany. It doesn't really exist even in France. You know, these three things are what made Britain unique.
There was a quote from somebody about small squadrons or little squadrons. I can't remember who it was. It might have been Thatcher. I don't know. But some politician said this, that Britain was full of little squadrons who did things, who looked after that guild and that union, and that school staff and so on, who were really invested in their own little project that made a huge difference in that area. I think this is a big thing, because you can care about something when it's within your scope of influence. If it gets too big, then you can't influence it anymore. So it ceases to be yours and you cease to be invested in it. I think this is a big thing with the British character.
Yeah. And it destroys your confidence as well when you have nothing that you have, like, some actual level of influence over. I was saying in a chat the other day that a man will accept being bottom of the barrel in his job 40 hours a week if he is respected as a local football coach for children or something, or a scout leader.
Yes. You know, I think also ideally respect within the within his staff as well would be ideal, but
that would be perfect.
That might be much to ask, I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, like, no, not everyone's going to be a phenomenal at business or in the workplace, but, you know, the idea was in this idealized version of the past we're talking about, you would be able to craft something out where you would say, I really like volunteering on the weekend in the scouts and being a woodsman and teaching these children all these activities. And I like that I'm respected when I'm doing this. Or, you know, you would run a five-a-side league and people would say, well, you know, Jonathan over there, he's running the five-a-side league in this part of the city. And that's a necessary part of all our life that we enjoy. So, you know, we respect him for it. The current society that we have is completely managerial and so broad that, you know, if you want to run a five-a-side, if you want to compete in a five-a-side tournament now, you Google five-a-sides near me and there's some corporation which is running them and you pay them a small fee and you have no idea who's actually organizing it.
This is appalling. Oh, my God. Yeah. See, another thing I realized was that you might remember with the David Cameron administration, one of their big things was free schools.
Yeah.
But it became clear that the free schools were not run. It was supposed to free up the school from the local educational authority. So it would have much more independence in how it operated. And sounds like a great idea. But the way it actually played out was that corporations, organizations got involved and So a free school would be it would be one of many that were run by this organization or that. Yeah. And I remember one of them was, I think, called ARC or something. Like, had one of these typically bland corporate names. And then the same is actually true of private schools as well. A lot of them are now no longer independent in that sense. They are part franchises, of a corporation's portfolio. And it will administer quite a large number of them. So the littleness is gone. The localness is gone. The specialness is gone. I think this is something that touches everyone immediately. They're disturbed by it. It seems crap. It seems soulless. Again,
well, it is crap and soulless. It doesn't just seem it.
But what I mean is, it even seems it. You know, people who don't even know anything about it, they just think, "Oh no!" It disappoints you when you realize this.
Yeah, but so this is the sort of thing that these are the sorts of ideas and small, right? You know, running a school, for instance. We have the ability now because of the free school thing. Yes, it's there's private companies which are snapping these schools up and putting them part of their portfolios, and there's all sorts of corruption which is going on in the free school projects as well, where a company will buy up all these schools, and then they will also buy up the cleaning companies which service schools, and there's all these sorts of weird scams which are going on. But a school, a small school, say like a primary school or something, doesn't need a massive budget. It doesn't need a massive staff, and you can, with relatively minor organizations, set up a relatively based school, right? This is the sort of thing you could do, and inject a bit of this localism, a bit of this, having the ability for teachers and local people to have power over their lives. You can inject this back into their world. And this is maybe the sort of thing we should be looking at doing as well, or in finding ways to encourage and champion, as part of saying, okay, people, you think everything's broken? Well, here's new ideas for you. And maybe the leftists would just pick up a lot on that for us as well, because they tend to be into localism and small businesses and that sort of thing. So we can maybe partner with them even on that. But there's my broad point though is, because everyone else is bankrupt of these ideas, we really do need to start being the responsible ones and saying, no, this is how you should do it. And we're going to act relatively maturely. Okay, you can still have your anonymous Groupio account, but you keep that separate. Okay. We have accounts which are being relatively mature and saying, no, this is the idea, and we're going to state it forthrightly. And we're not going to just say, give it to the Tories or whatever.
Yeah, I agree. I think that gives me food for thought as well on a personal level, because a lot of what I say on Twitter is jokey. Mm. And perhaps it shouldn't be. I don't know. I think a lot of us came of age with all of this in a time when we were accustomed to edgy humor and being over the top and so on. And also trolling people and being perhaps more aggressive than we should be. I don't know.
Well, it's also, you say we were coming of age, right? So yeah. It's a bit difficult, I think, to ask an 18-year-old to be responsible for the future of his country. But
but I was 33 when I got into this.
Okay,
or 31 rather. Yeah, but I'm just thinking about mid 2010s Twitter. You know.
Sure. Okay. Fair enough. But I mean, you say your content's jokey. I mean, that's fine, right? You can post some edgy stuff, and jokes, I think, are, again, it's an important part of British life and character. You can't just ignore that. But you can probably make room for both on your timeline quite easily. You can say, we're going to make a bunch of jokes, and we're going to do a mean campaign and, troll the shit out of some Guardian journalist. But then you say, well, okay, now I'm going to do a thread with some serious thought. And you do both. So you draw people in with the humor, and then you say, yeah, I'm more than just a comedian.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Substack, for example, is completely serious. I don't do any shit posting or anything like that on there. The vast majority of my videos are the same. I think I did do a few sort of humorous, sarcastic ones early on, but didn't really take to that. But Twitter is different in that sense. It's sort of ephemeral. Of course, it isn't really ephemeral because everything is stored. Mm-hmm. If not on Twitter, you can wipe your timeline, but it's archived somewhere. So it's worth bearing in mind. I think you're absolutely right about expanding and bringing people in who would previously have been very would have been opposed to us. And obviously the example that you alluded to earlier was the TERFs, the people, the lefties who are shocked and horrified by the trans thing. That's an interesting case study, a sort of example. And again, I've written an essay about this called The Gender Criticals.
Mm.
It's on my Substack. Because the problem there is they are shocked and horrified by the trans thing, kids being encouraged towards puberty blockers and whatever. But even though they understand that this is very dark and they understand that it's come from the left,
mm-hmm.
they still remain on the left. They still want to hold on to that worldview. That's a problem because, well, for obvious reasons, it means that they're not really, they don't really understand what's going on, the full extent of it. Or maybe they do and they just can't handle it and they want to delude themselves that, no, we can continue, we can return to 2012 and just take a different path. We won't go in for...
I think when you're talking about Graham Linehan, I can't pronounce his name, but...
it's just Linehan. That's all.
Linehan, okay. Yeah, Graham Linehan. When you're talking about him in particular, I think you're correct. Some of the other people... I think have moved to the right, not fully, but they have definitely made steps in that direction. But even Linehan, he did his apology video. Do you remember that for Count Dankula?
Yes.
Remember that one?
Yes,
so even he was at least then saying, "All right, I was wrong when I attacked you." So even people like him, I think he can bring more over.
I don't think that people, you know, once he's made his apology, I don't think that people should then continue haranguing him that he wasn't always this wise,
yeah.
You know, that he made mistakes. And you've got to just get over it and let the person move on. It's a matter of where they now move to. That's what really matters.
Yeah, and we need to find a space for them. And I don't know, that space can't be at the top of our movement. It can't be anywhere near the top of our movement, but it does need to be a space for these people to slot into. And it's, you know, that's difficult to do without idolizing them, and even more difficult when most of us can't exactly talk to them directly. Some people, if you're a big enough influencer, you can probably send them a DM and see how they respond. And some of these people are actually, from what I heard, they are relatively receptive to that approach, but most people don't have that ability. So it's difficult to see how to slot them in. But
I'll tell you a very strange thing. I've never said this publicly. Actually, it happened about a year ago. I was in London. I was in a cafe, a greasy spoon type sort of cafe, and a comedian. I realized that at the next table along, sitting behind me, the next table, was a fucking comedian. It was Jerry Sadowitz.
Right, okay, yeah.
very strange. And it was just after he'd been kicked out of the Edinburgh Festival. So, yeah, about 9 months, 12 months ago, something like that. Whenever that was, it was just a few months after that had happened. And he was still... It was still sort of like Graham Linehan is. When you see Graham Linehan interviewed now, he's sort of shell-shocked and dazed at what's happened. He can't believe it. And, you know...
Did you try and speak to him?
My friend did, yeah. It was clear that... You see, that's the thing. It becomes clear just from little things that they see, subtle little things, that they're still on the left. They're still existing in that world. Even though it has cut them off, You know, they're now like an orphan, but they're still there. They're still there. It's like they're still in the family home, even though the family have moved out now and the kid's still there. You know, it's very strange. It's like they cannot bring themselves to accept the full reality that of the situation, that they will never be welcome again. I mean, the only, and I said this in the essay, the only path back for them would be to completely condemn, like, to disavow the path that they've taken and supplicate, you know, really suck up to the status quo. Mm. And it would have to seem completely sincere. Because if it looked like they were just doing it to get their career back, then no one would, you know, take it seriously at all.
I mean, it's particularly weird in the West now, because in China, when this exact same thing was going on under Maoism and the Cultural Revolution, if you did apologize profusely and published enough articles in local communist papers that seemed sincere, you would be allowed back. You would have years in the wilderness. But there was lots of figures, which, you know, including Deng Xiaoping, who ended up leading the party in its transformation of China to become what it is today. He was cast out into the wilderness and then brought back. And there were many other figures at the top of the CCP, which did exactly the same. They were cast out, they apologized profusely, they had their time away, and then they brought back again. I've not seen anyone brought back in the West. It seems that when we castigate someone and when we evict, it's permanent. So we're worse than Maoism in a way.
Well, I think that's probably because of our belief in morality, moralism, you could say. It's not just that the person has made a mistake, like a tactical. They've gone down they've chosen the wrong route in the maze. No, we believe that it reflects on their moral nature.
Mm.
Their character. So someone who says the wrong thing about gay marriage is a bad person. And so it's very difficult for them to undo that. They can't just say, well, you know, I was bad last Tuesday, but it's now the following Friday and I'm good again. Please believe me, I'm good. I've changed. Or it was last year, I've changed since last, I'm a different moral creature now. People don't believe that, because of course it doesn't work like that.
It's a strangely intrinsic view of that we have in the West, of like saying, yes, you are, as you say, you know, you're just a bad person, which is odd for the left to buy into, because they're meant to all be about nature and not nature but nurture, and that's, it's your environment that changes you, that's what they profess, but it doesn't seem to be what they believe.
No, on the one hand they'll say, you know, like something like society makes us racist.
Yeah,
we all come into this as a blank slate and then the systemic racism makes us racist, but they don't apply the same thing when they say you were once racist but now you're a fantastic guy, you're a great guy. I don't think I've ever heard someone say that.
It'll happen to you one day, don't worry.
Yeah. I'm still waiting for that invitation to the Oscars. This is the thing about rehabilitation. I mean, I'm trying to think of examples of that. It's very difficult. I mean, there have been a few in America, like Mel Gibson sort of is accepted, sort of isn't, is muddy with him. I think that in most cases it is a lifelong thing. I mean, J.K. Rowling and Graham Linehan, they'll never... If Harry Potter, if it hadn't been absolutely massive, I mean, she would be even more screwed than she is.
No, of course.
I think the sheer massive power of it culturally and financially sort of cushioned her to some extent, but only to some extent. She's being cancelled effectively.
She's effectively as big a celebrity as it's possible to get.
Yeah.
You remember that? Who was that actor? He was the star of House of Cards and other things.
Oh, yes, Kevin Spacey.
So Kevin Spacey has been acquitted now of all charges. and he was found not guilty. And there was a civil suit against him, which is normally how they, you know, how they get you in America. If the criminal charges fail, they're like, we'll do a civil one. It's lower standard of proof. But he won the civil suit as well. So it seems as far as the law is concerned, despite all of the action against him, he's kind of innocent, but he's not been brought back. Despite the left losing, they still won't say, well, maybe you're fine. Maybe you should have a space. Yeah, he's still gone. Innocence is not enough.
It's a strange thing. I think that's probably because it involved underage boys. So they can't... It's weird because at the same time, they're legitimizing that whole thing with the trans kids and drag kids. I mean, it's just obviously perverse and it's obviously sort of proto-pedophilic. But it's okay because it's trans. But with him, I think it's just... I mean, another interesting one is Russell Brand. A few months ago, and I talked about it. I even started writing an essay about it, and then it all blew over. It just stopped. So I thought, well, I'm already boring my audience talking about it, so I'm not going to write about it as well. But it interested me what happened there.
I think the police are technically investigating him, so it might pop up again. But yeah, in terms of the media attention, it has just disappeared because they couldn't get the scalp, so they just moved on.
Yeah, I think that was partly because he had already detached from the mainstream, so he just didn't need them. There was no way, there was nothing that they could really hold against him except his, manipulate him with, except his YouTube earnings, and they did deprive, they did take those away. They demonetized his channel. Well, that was really the only, I mean, they could have him banned from YouTube, but I think they didn't want to do that because it was just, it would just be too obvious a move. So,
it would be. When we're saying, I haven't watched any of Brand's content, but when we're talking about people laundering our ideas and he's moved away from the mainstream, how much of what we talk about is he repeating? Do you know?
Well, I remember a few years ago now, he actually said maybe nationalism, maybe it's normal for people to care about their own country. I mean, you can't believe that someone needs to say this. That was a controversial thing to say. I think he even brought it to the matter of race. I think he said, isn't it sort of natural for people to have an affinity with their own type? I can't remember. It was like he was wandering in the jungle at night and he was bumping into trees and stuff. He said something like that. As for more recently, I mean, as far as I can tell, I watched a few of his videos on Rumble when this whole thing happened. And he seems to be very against Big Pharma, the banks, you know, high finance, that whole thing. I think he's also into conspiracy stuff. I don't know, because I think he was married to a Rothschild.
He's married to a Rothschild.
At one point, at least. Or a date.
I thought he was married to Katy Perry.
I can't remember who it was, but it's strange. But he now rants against the mega rich, the elite, and so on. And it's kind of...
He sounds like he's reverted to the old left talking points, to be honest, more than going to our side. And so he's maybe not an example of this. He's just someone who's detached because...
I think, but the thing is, because he remains detached from the mainstream, it could happen at any time.
Yeah.
I don't think the left are going to accept him ever. So I don't know. He's not someone that I invest, you know, I don't really admire him. I find him likable. I just want to make it clear that I don't put him up on a pedestal or anything. I just thought that what was done to him was so obviously outrageous.
No, you're 100% right. But he is also an interesting example of being able to go your own way just on the back of your charisma. And it would be nice if we had someone of that level of charisma, even if, you know, they're a bit schizo or whatever, on our side, you know. We don't have that at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is one of the good things about social media, that someone like that can go it alone. And presumably it's working out fairly well for him. I don't know if he's making as much as he used to make, as when he was part of the machine, so to speak. I doubt it, but I still think I would expect that he's making a very, very good living from what he's doing. And yeah, it would be great if more people did similar. But to get back to what we were saying at the start, I do think that it will become increasingly common for things like that. Figures like Russell Brand, I don't think he'll be the last by any means, because the mainstream is so utterly discredited and so utterly corrupt, and obviously so.
And I think the discrediting is only gonna get worse at least in Europe. So within America, Trump has the potential to do a kind of revitalization. If America withdraws from the world a little bit, if they say we're going to exploit our natural resources a bit more, they sort out the southern border, all these things are possible in a Trump presidency, and it would dramatically improve the material conditions of American life. It wouldn't solve the rot, but it would, you know, make things better enough that the American regime can keep on churning. Europe doesn't really have that option. The cheap energy solution is Russia. Russia is not going to give us cheap energy without massive concessions. We're really involved with what's going on with the Mediterranean and Africa. We're probably going to be accepting God knows how many Palestinians. Europe's in a very different place. So whoever comes in charge within the UK premiership, within the German premiership, they're not going to be able to really really solve the European problem without a completely radical change. And I don't think that radical change is going to happen. So within Europe, there is a lot more opportunity, I think, for these disaffected individuals to come to our side. And we really need to be capitalizing on this more than the Americans are.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we should be looking to attract, to draw more people into our orbit. And I think, as you say, there's never been a better time for it, because things are so bad in the mainstream, and in the left and in the center. The government is obviously awful. The mainstream culture is obviously directionless. So I agree. I think that we're living in a very interesting time, a very fertile time for new ideas and new collaborations. So that is a nice note of optimism.
Yeah. Spengler said optimism is moral cowardice, but screw it, I'll be optimistic.
Sometimes it just seems kind of natural. And I'm not saying that, you know, the historical cycle has been averted or whatever. I'm just saying things look poised to, I think we're heading into a better period than the one we've been in, put it that way.
Yeah, or at least there'll be potential for us to carve out something. If not an entire nation, then some kind of self-governing community somewhere where we can live what we would call a morally righteous life. I think even if we're not going to have total victory, I'm pretty sure that's possible. It would just still be a lot of work.
Yeah, of course. Okay, there are a few super chats for you.
Sure.
Stephen B says, it's in the news that former President Trump has just been banned from running as president because he is accused of ordering an insurrection. Fucking outrageous. The word civil war is trending on Twitter. I don't think that will happen, but it will accelerate the decline and fracturing of the West. So Trump has been banned from running as president.
In one state, I'm not sure which one. I did see this briefly, but I haven't read into it yet. But yes, in one state in America, they're saying he's not allowed to run for president. But there'll be legal action against that, and it's quite possible he'll win that legal action. However, it's kind of like the remember when he was arrested and he posted a mugshot, right? And everyone went wild for it. Trump really wants to say the system's against me. One, because the system kind of is against him, but it also makes him look cool. And him being banned from running for president whilst he's the most popular candidate for president is certainly going to help his vote in other states.
Yeah, definitely. There was one other thing that I meant to mention earlier, which is that the a judge has ordered that Epstein's client list be published, at least in part. And that's going to happen early, very early next year, like start of January. So again, it was related to something that you were saying. I've forgotten what it was now, but basically it's, who knows who's going to be named. I think it was something like 170 names are going to be published.
Yeah.
I mean, that could cause all sorts of chaos.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the sort of thing which you can probably expect more of, which is going to discredit our current set of elites hugely. I mean, I'm even seeing on Twitter and a few other places more of the Pizzagate stuff start coming up, you know, and don't really want to get into that now because it's all very conspiratorial, but who knows? Who knows what's going to pop up?
Right, yeah, someone's just sent me, it's Colorado is the state.
There we go.
It's banned him. And he's it's going to the Supreme Court, apparently.
Yeah.
So there we go. All right, and, okay, Atlas Rain Axis says, I miss the world my grandmother lived in, but I love my freedoms as a modern woman. Seems like things went wrong when women got the vote. Has anyone in the dissident right got a clear vision of the structure of society that they want after conservatives gain power again? Where are we headed? Is there anything you'd like to say to that?
Has anyone got a clear vision? I mean, there's a number of competing visions, but I think everyone would agree there needs to be a far more harmonious relationship between the sexes, and that not only women getting the votes, but probably voting in general was not necessarily a good thing. When Churchill stated that democracy was the best, the worst system apart from all of the other systems that have been tried, he was saying that when democracy had the vote had only been given to all British men and all British people over 18, that had only been in place for like 10 years, 20 years, something like that. And some of that time, democracy was cancelled because we were in a world war. So when he was saying democracy is the best system, apart from everyone's been tried, it hadn't even been tried yet.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Well, I mean, the thing is, we've certainly seen it play out since then. And I don't think, I mean, I just don't think it's a good system. And no. I see the appeal of it. I understand the logic of it. I just don't think it actually works that way in reality.
It just doesn't. And I think if Putin has continued success, right? So Russia now has grown its economy despite the sanctions, and it's looking that it's not, the sanctions have been extraordinarily ineffective, even in the niche ways that we assumed it would be effective. So there was an assumption when the sanctions were put in place that they would be able to block Russia's development of high tech weaponry, because most of the manufacturing capability and patents and knowledge necessary for the high tech stuff resided within Western companies. But we're seeing now, I think there was it happened relatively recently in this Russian war, that their suicide drones now have night vision, and that's something that the West can't really do, because a night vision as it's produced in Western companies is really, really expensive, and you wouldn't put down a suicide drone because it would just be, you know, a stupid waste. But Russia's doing it. So it seems that Russia is able to produce some high-tech stuff, at least, as far cheaper way than we can within the West. So if this Russian system continues to pan out, not perfectly, but, you know, reasonably prosperously, then you say, okay, Putin's autarkic system, that can work. When we look at what's happening within the Middle East, with Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they're, you know, successful, prosperous countries. I'm not a fan of the Muslim side of it, but the monarchy side of it seems to work, right? And they're able to create a relatively good style of life. What's happening in China, they're again created a really nice, safe society, basically, for the Chinese, as long as you don't criticize the government. So people are looking at these alternate modes of running a country aside from democracy, and they're seeing it's resulting in better outcomes. So I think the idea of democracy is one of these things which at some point will be delegitimized even within the West.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because on the one hand, right now we're told to love democracy and very much value it, and that this enemy is an enemy of our democracy, a threat to our democracy, and all that. But yeah, I could see it being recast as a retarded system, but actually by both the left and the right, because nobody gets what they want in a democracy except the powerful, which is exactly what it's supposed to work against happening. That's the whole idea. It doesn't actually work out that way at all. And then there's one final super chat. This is again from Atlas Rain Axis. Thank you. She says, in America, in my grandmother's generation, the women joined service organizations that did community projects that improved their local area. The groups gave them something meaningful to do. Women don't have the time to join organizations now because we all have to work. Yeah, this is a huge thing. I think communities really suffered when this change happened and women went into the workplace. A lot of the activity that maintained a community, both involving childcare and not, it just went away. And that means communities sort of evaporates.
I will say that's completely true, but I will push back against it in one way, in that you say we don't have time now. People just worked more back then. That's something you have to remember. You know, they would do the normal work week, and then they would do the volunteering stuff on top. The hours were not less than at work, and the men would also be volunteering in these various different groups. So one of the cultural changes, which has been a negative for it, I think, in life in the West, is that we just become more lazy. And probably when real politics, like I said, within Europe in particular, reemerges, we're just going to be working harder. And, you know, that if we want to survive, that means, yes, you're going to have to do 40-hour week if you're a man or a woman, and then you're going to have to do your local stuff on top, because if you don't, everything's going to go to shit. So this is my optimism, is that you're going to be working more.
Well, thank you. All right. Excellent. Well, this has been a very interesting talk, Maven Politics. So thank you very much.
No, thank you for inviting me. And I'll try and capture as many of these other guests as I possibly can.
Oh, thank you. I hope it's an interesting mix. I mean, that's what I go for. And I hope that other of the streams are both interesting and practically useful for people. Okay, the next one will be in the Distributist. That'll be in about 35 minutes. So I'll see you for then. But in the meantime, Maven Politic, debuting on Millennial this year. I should have said that. Thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Great. Thank you very much. And have a Merry Christmas, everyone.
Okay. Thank you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. All aboard. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.